Now, seeing the dynamic duo of Dan Atwood and Dan Atwood, I've done it again. Dan Atwood, I don't know why I've done this, and Nick Goldberg from Affinity Wheels once more. And today, they're going to attempt to unravel the intricacies of the Care Act, which, although becoming law last May, I think I'm right in saying in many of its provisions of the Act don't come into force until June next year. Is that right?
That is correct, Scott.
I'd forget Dan Atwood. I thought he was going to say Dan Aykroyd.
I'm having a very senior moment again today. Now, look, before we get down to the nitty-gritty, just a word of caution. Clearly, on a programme like this, we can scratch the surface and talk only in generalities. And if you want to talk over your individual circumstances, give the guys at Affinity a call, because they'll be pleased and come and talk to you in your own home. You don't even have to go anywhere yourself. The number to call is 01245 850 000, so it's 850 and then another three zeros, but don't worry if you missed it, as we'll give it to you again a little bit later on. Anyway, to business. First off, perhaps one of you would like to state briefly what the new Act is aimed at achieving, and indeed what's different about the new legislation. Who wants to go with that one?
Well, I guess that one's going to fall to me.
It's Dan. Well done, Dan.
Right. Well, first off, Scott, the Act sets out new rights for carers. It emphasises the need to prevent and reduce care needs, and it introduces a national eligibility threshold for care and support, which specifies each individual's needs and their circumstances, in which every council in England must offer care and support for adults. That's obviously vulnerable adults. In addition to that, the Act introduces a cap on the costs that people will have to pay for their care, and introduces a universal deferred payment scheme intended to prevent anyone from having to sell their home in their lifetime to pay for residential care. Secondly, the Act sets out to address a series of identified failures across the health and care system, and it does so by setting out Ofsted-style ratings for hospitals and care homes, and that's so that patients and the general public can compare organisations or services and make informed choices about where to go.
I noticed that you said very neatly there, in your lifetime, that you don't have to sell your house. So it's not quite as simple as thinking that you won't have to sell it, is it?
No, it isn't. I mean, under the current system, when a person enters residential care on a permanent basis, the value of the home is disregarded from the means test if it continues to be occupied in whole or in part by a partner, a spouse or a living partner. And the Department of Health indicates that the government intends for that position to remain the same, but the new Act creates a cap on the care costs, and that's expected initially to be set at £72,000 and adjusted annually thereafter.
Can I just pick you up on something there? You said if the home is occupied by a partner, what if it's occupied by an offspring?
If the offspring is under the age of 18, then it will be disregarded, and if the offspring is in receipt of means-tested benefits, then it will also be disregarded.
But the minute they turn 19?
If they're employed, then the property can be taken into account.
Right, okay.
Yeah, which can be quite a bit of a nuisance, really.
I would say, well, I think that's the understatement of the year.
Absolutely.
Can we just clarify the partner bit?
Yeah.
Dan, do you mean part owner or partner?
Well, a living partner, if you're living as husband and wife nowadays,
yes.
That would classify as partner.
Yeah.
But a co-owner would count as well, irrespective of whether they're a partner or not.
Right, okay, fair enough.
Okay.
Continue, please.
Well,
I've interrupted you. Of course you have.
Well, so what I've said is that the cap is expected initially to be set at £72,000. And what it also intends to do is extend the means test upper limit for financial assistance to £27,000. That's currently £23,250. That value will also be different if property is included. That figure's going to rise to 118,000.
Hmm.
Now, the lower threshold also may increase. That's currently 14,250, and that may increase to 17,000.
Now, what are these lower thresholds? What do they refer to?
Well, if you're the thresholds are there basically to assess whether or not you are liable to meet all or some of the costs of your care. So, if you're below the lower threshold, the current,
if you don't have that amount of capital, in other words,
cash or property, then you won't be liable to pay towards your care at all. If you're above the upper threshold, then you're liable to pay for the full cost of the care. And in between those two figures, then there's a sliding scale
where
you may be subsidised.
But is it right that no individual would be exposed to personal liabilities of more than £72,000, or is that too much of a simplification?
Well, it is really, because the decision to implement the cap on care costs is coming really as a result of the recommendation of the Dilnot Commission some years ago. The Dilnot report said that a cap should be set on an individual's lifetime contributions towards their social care costs, and that the means test should be extended. Now, Dilnot recommended that that cap be set at $35,000, but the government has opted for a higher cap and intends that to be $72,000. Now, the idea of the cap is that it specifies the maximum expenditure an individual will have to make towards the cost of care they receive, and that, of course, would be whether in their own home or in a care home.
You can see them and in hear the butt eyes, coming. Yeah.
Well, of course, that doesn't mean the local authority is going to pick up the tab in full. The cap is not intended to cover all the costs associated with long-term care. It doesn't include what you would refer to as the hotel costs of care, such as bed and board.
They don't feed you.
You can be in there, not be fed, or not know where to sleep, basically.
Yeah.
Also, any additional costs the individual incurs, such as if their care home is more expensive than the local authority allowance, that won't count either. So if a family want to get a better standard of care for a vulnerable parent, then they're going to have to dig deep and find the money for
cough
that
up
as well. The deferred payment scheme, which enables people to defer the payment of care fees, that's a good idea. I mean, I don't think anyone would disagree that that's a good idea. However, when payments are deferred, they will be subject to interest, of course, and any outstanding fees and interest would have to be repaid to the local authority after that individual's death and when the house is sold.
And would the interest be at the standard rate, or would it be a rate given by the council?
No, that'll be a statutory rate that's applied, and it's not loan shark interest. It's actually quite reasonable. And there's also, you do get time to pay after that individual dies. You get about 3 months to pay it as well. So they're not come knocking on your door, taking it down to get their money.
And right now I'm talking to Dan Atfield and Nick Goldberg from Affinity about the effects of the Care Act, which became law last May. And we were just talking about the cap of £72,000. But I guess that from all you've said so far, it doesn't mean the local authority's going to pick up the tab in full, does it? Who's going to take that one?
Are they going to pick up the tab in full? No. I think this is setting out different requirements for the local authority, that if someone has to go into care, then there's a certain amount of value that they're allowing you to have. Is it much different? Not really. They just perhaps rejigged it as to how it affects people.
But you would get the benefit of the £72,000. That would come off the bill, the end bill, would it? whatever it is.
Remember, they're capping the care cost, that part.
Yes.
But they're not capping the other part, which is the bit, as Dan said, like the rent fees, the you know, the room fees, the electric, the gas, the heat, and the food. That sort of cost, it has no cap on it.
You continue to pay for that.
So you'll continue to pay that up and over and above the £72,000, yeah?
Yes.
Of course, the upper limit has gone up to £27,000, and the lower limit's gone up with it. But yeah, I mean, you know, people will still be paying for their care.
What's the £27,000 for then?
Well, £27,000 is they're saying that if you've got over £27,000, that's the point that you pay for all of your care.
What, including,
and then they cap it at 72 for a certain part of it.
Right. So over £27,000, if you've got that, then you're liable to pay costs, but it's still going to be capped at 72,000. Is that correct?
For part of it. That's the cost of your care.
Yes.
But the cost of where you're living and the cost of your food and electric and that sort of stuff, that's different.
On top.
That's extra. That goes on top. Hotel charge, I believe. Is it, Dan?
Yes.
Right. Hotel charge. Yeah, okay. I like it. Okay, sorry, I've interrupted you. Go on.
No, so, I mean, look, you said, are you right in thinking that individuals are meant to save and plan for possible care? I think a big issue is that, look, unfortunately, a lot of people haven't saved for long-term care, and if they have, then you know, perhaps they don't want to see all of their savings go to paying for their care, yeah? We go more on the planning side. To be fair, I mean, look, there's certain things that individuals can do to plan for care. Now, look, we in part of our presentations that we make, we use a crystal ball, don't we, Dan? And I think we mentioned this on previous occasions. And within that crystal ball, it has sort of keywords like stroke, dementia, long-term care, remarriage after death, you know, divorce of a beneficiary, keywords like that which are important to people. And our line says, look, you know, at Affinity Legal Group, we can't predict your future, but we can help you plan for it. And of course, that is all that we can do. So we can't go and point to people in the street and say, well, you're going into care.
No.
And you're going to get married after death and blah, blah, blah. And of course, in the main, neither can they. So all we suggest is, look, if people want to ensure that they're putting as much provision in as they can to protect what they've got for their families, then there are certain things that they can put in place whilst they are well, whilst they're okay, to reduce the impact of something happening in the future. I'm going to pass this over to you now, Dan. I mean, you see it any different from that, Dan?
Well, can I just ask you one
question?
My question is, if you didn't save anything, you didn't do anything at all, a lot of the times the state comes along and picks up a tab because they say, well, we can't leave you on the street or whatever, and you haven't saved a bean, so would you get away with that?
Well, therein lies one of the biggest arguments about the whole care funding system, Scott, because a lot of the clients that we speak to feel that the system is unfair insofar as somebody who hasn't either saved or accumulated assets for care purposes, they don't have to pay, and of course they'll enjoy exactly the same level of care as somebody who has saved and accumulated assets.
And now, done the right thing, as they keep saying.
We'll all have different opinions on that, but yeah. It is very emotive, and it's very often raised by people that we speak to. But, you know, Nick is referring to planning, and so some of the things that you can do to plan for these eventualities, we have touched on, of course, in previous programmes.
Yeah.
And I think that we're going to need to recap on that, because
it's a good idea.
It's all too much to take in just on the strength of one listening.
And right now I'm talking to Dan Atfield and Nick Goldberg from Affinity about the effects of the Care Act, which became law last May. Now, we were just talking about the fact that individuals, it would appear, are supposed to save and plan for possible care. But it all sounds to me a little bit pie in the sky. So how on earth would the general public be given information that they require? because I rather suspect that most people will just carry on in happy ignorance and therefore could potentially face a financial catastrophe. So what practical steps can anyone take to protect themselves?
Okay, well,
Nick, you're going to take that one.
Hello.
Hello.
Thanks, Scott. A lot of people say ignorance is bliss. We perhaps look at ignorance of the law as no excuse,
yep.
a different way of looking at things. I think, look, the question is everyone out there going to be bothered about protecting their value so it passes to the people that they love and trust, and ensuring that people are going to get what they want? And the answer is no. Okay, and we got to be honest with that. Does everyone worry about their wills? In fact, a big proportion of people don't have wills. The government makes allowances for that, and of course, there's a law in place which says, look, if someone hasn't put a will in place, this is where the value is going to go. Okay, and you've seen that, the air
Absolutely.
Hunters on television, yeah?
It's frightening.
Well, not necessarily frightening.
It's frightening that people don't make the wills.
Absolutely. So certainly when they've got people that they love and they want it to go in a certain direction.
Yeah.
I believe the issue is, I mean, and there are a couple of issues. Number one, people don't want to think about death.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, people don't want to talk about planning because, you know, if I start talking about my planning,
it could happen.
It might mean I'm going to die. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And also, people don't, you know, they don't want to know about care. So if we don't want to think we're going to die, we don't want to think that there's a chance we can lose our capacity. Of course, there are different people, and certainly a lot of our clients fall into this bracket, where they're looking at it from a different point of view, and of course, they're thinking, look, what can I do as a client to ensure that my children, my wife, my husband, whoever it is they're talking about, get what, you know, the maximum that they can get out of what we've got, and so that they can avoid certain pitfalls.
Mm.
So, for example, look, if in the event of if I was living with someone and I wasn't married, and I'm sure, you know, we all know that happens quite a lot these days. If I died without a will,
yes,
and I was living common law, then my partner gets nothing. Mm. So that's a big thing to be aware of, because of course they're not under the next of kin law. Yeah,
yep.
Now they could make a claim under the Inheritance Provision for Families,
yes,
and Dependency Act that we mentioned in one of our previous programs.
But
there's no guarantee that they're going to get anything. Yeah,
no.
So a simple will put in place at the right time can say, look, when I die, you know, my money goes to this person, and if they're not about, then it goes on to these people.
Yeah.
One thing that we need to be aware of course, is what we've mentioned before, which was jointly owned property.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, for example, we talked about blended families. You've got some people where they've come from one family and they've got children. Perhaps they got divorced or they're widows. And then you've got their partner or their new husband, wife has come from another family with,
yes,
exactly the same situation. And of course, the problem is, what people are not aware of, is with jointly owned property, jointly owned property passes to the survivor on death,
yes,
and it doesn't pass via the will. So again, that's another thing to be aware of. If you want to ensure that the right people are going to get your value on your death and that your will is going to be, you know, going to cover everything, then you have to make sure you're owning your property in the correct manner and that you've put the right planning in place via your will so that when you die, it is there for the benefit of perhaps each other, and then it passes on to the children.
Yep.
Because, of course, we know that we've had these discussions where money is passed outside, or it's gone to a new, you know, to the partner who's then subsequently remarried or subsequently changed their will or gone into care, and then,
sure,
the whole value has been taken into account. We do trusts with those tenants in common so it can preserve rights for the other partners. That's important stuff. Okay. Also, we talked about powers of attorney, didn't we, Dan?
Yeah.
And powers of attorney was about the fact that, and I know Dan took this one on when it was meant to be my talk.
Well, you've done a runner. You've done a runner.
And powers of attorney have been, certainly the new lasting powers of attorney have been something that people need to put in place now, whilst they're well enough to do it, so that they can make choices about who they trust to manage their affairs in the event of them not being able to do it themselves. So again, good planning, you betcha, because of course if they don't put that planning in place and they lose capacity, then it doesn't automatically pass to those family members or their friends that they might have wanted it to pass to. So again, we've got wills, we're talking about different ways of owning a property, we're talking about trusts in the wills, and we're talking about powers of attorney. I'm going to pass the last one over to Dan. We do the lifetime asset trusts, don't we, Dan? They still have an effect, of course, since this change in law.
Yeah, they do. A lifetime asset trust, as listeners will recall, is a way of setting up a trust while you're still alive in your lifetime and transferring assets to that trust. Can be the home, it can be liquid assets, with a view to ring-fencing those assets from a range of threats and such as avoiding probate, remarriage after death, which Nick referred to. And they can be beneficial for things like divorce, long-term care, that type of thing.
So basically, okay, if you do nothing at all, then the state will probably look after you, but they'll certainly take all of the assets that you have, and if you want to leave them to whoever, then you really need to get the proper advice from people like yourselves.
Proper advice is essential, but not don't just listen to the advice.
Heed take it.
And take some action.
All right, well, look, thanks again for all of that. As we said at the outset, there are so many variables available, and in a programme like this, we can only scratch the surface. So my advice to you, as always, is to pick up the phone and call the guys at Affinity. He'll be delighted to give you a free consultation in your own home, where you'll be able to talk through your particular circumstances and sort out something which is tailor-made to your requirements. And that telephone number is 01245 850000. So it's 01245 850000. Very complicated. Anyway, you're going to be with us again, I think, on the 11th of May. So what are you going to be talking about then? Or are we going to go back over what we've done?
Yeah, I think it's we discussed this earlier, and I think it makes sense to recap on some of the topics that we've covered to date in the last few months, and perhaps expand on those so that they sink in a little more, shall we say.
Seems reasonable to me. I certainly need it sinking in. Fine, well, we look forward to seeing you then on the 11th of May, and we'll do it all over again. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.